Today we're here with Ms. Anne Fuqua, chronic pain patient and one of the leading advocates who was among the first to compile a list of patients who lost their lives due to suicide and other self-inflicted ailments. And with that, I'd like to welcome Ms. Fuqua. Thank you for joining us.
Hey, Dr. Joshi. Thank you so much for having me.
So before we begin to learn about your advocacy, I think it's important to learn your story as a chronic pain patient. Can you tell us a little bit about this journey and where you found yourself today?
Well, I have something called primary generalized dystonia. It's a movement disorder. It's in the same family as Parkinson's, but it's, and there's similarities, but it's different from Parkinson's. And Parkinson's actually runs on my dad's side of the family, and my father actually has Parkinson's. So that's, it's probably something that I got as a, to my genes. But when I was had intrathecal pump implanted. I was in nursing school at UAB. I was getting elevated liver enzymes from the drugs that I would take to control the dystonia. So this wonderful new technology, the intrathecal pumps, and they really have helped a lot of patients. It just wound up not being the right, it wound up not being the right thing for me because I wound up getting arachnoiditis from this, damage to my spinal cord that happened during the surgery to implant. And so the arachnoiditis, was something that developed, over the years and, really started to get the symptoms of it around 2009, 2010, but it had been present before that. And the opioids were something that I had been on for years, but it took a long time before I was able to appreciate that they were actually, and I had to get, and it was part of it, wasn't until I had gotten up to a higher dose that could see that it was actually impacting the dystonia. And you can see how I am now sitting here, completely still. I don't have nothing, I'm not twisted, one way or the other. Yeah, I can sit up straight. And this is something that, is the opioids. I was able to get off of all of the medications that cause terrible side effects that I was taking to treat the dystonia because of the opioids. And the opioids actually, did far more than all the muscle relaxers, dopamine agonists, and everything else that I took had ever done. And, I don't think that that's something that's like, it doesn't seem like that's the case for everybody, but I guess maybe it's a subset. We're all different, but for me, it was like a miracle. I mean, it's like being in a different body. And, I still hurt, but I mean, it's just being able to do, the things I want to do and be able to live on my own. I'm so grateful.
Thank you for sharing your journey. What point did you decide to become an advocate and to help other chronic pain patients with similar conditions like arachnoiditis and other chronic pain conditions?
One of the doctors that I saw, the one that I saw for the longest period, the one in Birmingham, Alabama, they had a patient class as part of their, and support group at their clinic. And that, was kind of beginning, just, seeing, okay, patients, trying to, get together and help one another, and we would, informally. But then from that, I helped, somebody would say, oh, well, a friend of mine, they had this happen, can you, their drug screen came up with something unexpected. They're not sure what this is. And, I had the background as a nurse and, just trying to look up and see what I could find. And, I came across, this app called Urintil that Dr. Jeff Fubin, who passed away about a year ago, had created. It was something that was designed for doctors to be able to, you know, to figure out why, you know, a particular patient's drug screen might have an unexpected result. And this, you know, became this, you know, that was kind of the beginning of, you know, this was just, you know, I had the app, you know, and on my little iPad 2, you know, it was ancient, and, you know, I, you know, would just tell, you know, people with, oh, well, you know, here, you know, that's a chart, you know, if you've got a, you know, something on your drug screen or whatever, and that was, you know, kind of something I did, and then it just kind of went from there. And then when my doctor's office, when my doctor retired in 2015, he closed his practice, pain practice, it was just, I think, but just fear because of what really was happening. You know, all the, with the regulatory changes were just probably too much. And when that happened, that was all these patients that I had known for years that were, you know, many of them just close to the mat, and we were all just left in this horrible position and desperately trying to find doctors. And, you know, it was just, I was one of the higher NME patients, and, could not find anybody literally in the state of Alabama that was willing to take me. And had it not been, just for Dr. Tennant, I wouldn't be here today. I wouldn't. Because, to me it's I want to be here as long as I can. I love my life. I don't want to be, here and not just taking up space and not able to enjoy the life that I have. And I felt like I was so, so lucky that Dr. Tennant took me as a patient, but at the same time, why wasn't everybody else so lucky to find doctors? And so many people that I cared about were just in horrible states. A lot of them aren't here anymore. And, it was like, gosh, I'm so lucky to be here. You know, at least if I'm here, you know, I've got to do something to make this better. You know, at least I can, feel decent. You know, I mean, at least I can, do more than somebody else that's just having a horrible time. And I just kind of threw myself, into this, from there.
I want to touch on a couple of things that you had mentioned because I think it's important to go over them in more detail. You had mentioned you have a nursing background. You had mentioned that you were lucky to find Dr. Tennant. And you and I both know Dr. Tennant very well. He is a luminary in the field of chronic pain, mm-hmm. and he is one of the first physicians to really demonstrate what it means to show compassion to patients. As an advocate and as a patient, particularly you with a nursing background, talk about this purgatory so many chronic pain patients find themselves in, where they're searching for the right physician, the right quality of care, and what that does to you as a patient, what that does to your disease state. Talk about just the whole process of being left out in this ether and trying to find a physician to care for you, particularly with your medical background.
I mean, I think it's probably one of the greatest academic harms that's occurring right now. It's not something that's like, mistakes happening in surgery. It's something that our healthcare system is doing. When you're not just suffering because you have a medical condition, but you're suffering because someone has, because either someone is an individual or the system, the whole just system has chosen to take your care away. That just creates this sense of just anger and frustration. And beyond that, you're already hurting and being angry and frustrated even more than you would be anyway, because you hurt. It just builds and creates this state that's increasingly unhealthy emotionally and physically in your body. Your body is just more wound up. You've got all this adrenaline and, the fight or flight response. You don't sleep, and it just creates a horrible cycle. And there are patients that used to be completely different people that could be, you know, just as normal as anybody, you know, anybody would meet on the street. And now they're just to talk to them, you know, they're completely different people. And it's just, it's heartbreaking because they've become people that, with the way that they respond, they're the people that doctors, you know, would not want to, and nurses would not want to help, because their responses aren't what they would expect from, you know, someone to have. But there is this anger and a sense of frustration and suspicion and, you know, this medical PTSD, whatever you want to call it. But it's just, it's heartbreaking because these patients, they become their own worst enemy. And that's just, to me, it's just one of the saddest parts about this.
Yeah. You particularly would be in a position to understand just how heartbreaking it is, because you were one of the first to start chronicling deaths by suicide for chronic pain patients. And it's an immensely sensitive topic, and so I want to give it all the respect that it deserves. So I want to first understand, why did you feel the importance to chronicle patients who would lose their lives by suicide? And when did you realize you needed to start creating a list?
Well, it's not just suicides that I've been documenting. It's lots of different causes of death. But the first death that, you know, I guess kind of started this was a really good friend of mine that was quadriplegic. He was basically thrown into a crawl after his doctor retired, and the doctor that replaced him decided to take him off of the medication he was on over a 5-day period. He called that a taper. And he, in spite of having been in his new doctor's office several times during that week, experiencing dysreflexia, this doctor did not change the course of treatment. And he suffered a massive heart attack and passed away, and his 6-year-old daughter found him. And paramedics did resuscitate him, but, you know, they had to discontinue life support, you know, a week later. And that little girl, her life is completely different now. She doesn't have her daddy. Her mama was killed in the car wreck where he suffered a, you know, broken neck. And, you know, I mean, this was government overreach that completely changed, you know, a little girl's life. I mean, how different is her, you know, and then, you know, he's not there. And it's just, to me, that was just like, and that, well, he was in the hospital, and I had, was that just, you know, was there, you know, just sitting on my computer. You know, I wasn't even a big computer person at the time, you know, really not a tech person at all. But I think just out of anger, like, what's happening? Or lots of people having heart attacks, you know, because they have, you know, one withdrawal. And I start Googling, and I was seeing, you know, some people that were having heart attacks and strokes, but mostly it was suicides. And so I was like, whoa, this is just, you know, just struck, this was 2014. May of 2014. And, you know, I just started keeping, you know, it started out as, obituaries and just screenshots or whatever, you know, that were printed out and, on my, you know, printed again, that's, you know, hello tech, you know, just, you know, on a table, you know, in the living room. And then, you know, they wound up getting stuck on the walls, and finally somebody was like, you know, you've got to do something about, you know, do something, do something with this. This does not need to be your wallpaper. And so that was how I learned how to, you know, make a spreadsheet. Me, that, you know, I had never done, you know, anything like that. I learned what a Google Drive was. And, you know, or Cloud Drive was, and, you know, learned how to, you know, all this, the computer technology. I was not a high-tech person at all, but, you know, and just started putting this and trying to get as much information as I could about his death. I would, if it was a social media report without somebody's name, you know, I would just try to cross-reference each of, you know, the reports that I had against the ones where I had names and ones where I didn't, so at least I could say, okay, well, I've got enough to say that this one's separate from others, because I didn't want to have encountered twice, or, to have people count twice, but then I didn't want people not represented, you know, because I want, to me, and it's like that these people have lost their lives, And as I start, yeah, and then I would, if I had the person's name, I would try to look up as much as I could about, you know, I could, you know, I could about them. I would try to find, you know, whatever information I could get, and then put that into a folder, and you know, and save it. You know, and some of this would be things that, you know, most of it just publicly accessible information. Sometimes, or sometimes the family has submitted, you know, had found, you know, just from, you know, had emailed and said, you know, this is my mother or brother or sister, you know, whatever, that, you know, passed away. You know, they would send me things. Sometimes it would be, you know, part of a medical record. I've got some death certificates. You know, I've got suicide notes, and I just would try to compile all of it together. And I wanted to keep this file private because that, you know, there were notes that, okay, it might be okay with some family members if it was posted, but you don't know how it would affect everybody. And so I keep the file itself, you know, the whole thing private, but I, you know, just from time to time post summary data, you know, with the, you know, kind of the, you know, how many are veterans, how many are civilians, how many are, you know, were suicides, how many were heart attacks, strokes, and they, you know, things are just, you know, just descriptive statistics. And right now, you know, it's just over, you know, 1,100 patients, that, you know, or 1,100, you know, reported, you know, deaths that I've got.
1,100.
Yes.
Wow. Before we continue, I want to first apologize for simply saying deaths by suicide, because the database is far more comprehensive, and so I should have been cognizant of that. Second of all, I just want to convey how impressed I am and how much respect I have for you in creating this database, particularly given you don't have an IT or software background, but you felt a need, you saw the importance in compiling this database, and you just did it. Can you maybe share some moments in which you had first started compiling this list and you thought, wow, what am I doing? Or, wow, this is really hard, but you persevered nevertheless? Because I think that's very important for people to understand.
It was, you know, especially the early ones, those were friends. And yeah, that was, wow. You know, I mean, you know, friends, and lots of friends. People that I knew, you know, really well locally, and some from online. And it was just, that was, I think that's, in a way, it probably kept me from getting bogged down. Because I felt like, you know, well, this has got to, you know, it made me, maybe approach things more, you know, in a more like, yeah, you know, I guess maybe more like, you know, a nurse, a help, you know, than like somebody that's in, at times. But I mean, there are others that, you know, I just still would be just bawling. There was one day, it was the day that, you know, Dr. Cortez and I, I got really mad one day in fall 2016, and that was my first time to get on Twitter. And just, you know, posted something, you know, tweeting towards to Kalani, Andrew Kalani. And I did not know Stephen Cortez, you know, we were both in the same, you know, both in Birmingham. He had come to UAB just as I left UAB to go to grad school. And he had followed me and replied. I had no idea, but I didn't know, no intention of going back to Twitter. I was just there to, you know, tell Kalani to give a piece of my mind. And it's like, no, and somebody was, you need to, you know, go back there. Yeah, somebody, you know, asking questions. And yeah, but this was probably about 8 or 9 months later. You know, I had gone to this event at a local university to hear Dr. Cortez and then David Gerling. They were having this kind of debate, you know, back and forth, you know, type lecture, you know. And, you know, I had, you know, Dr. Cortez and I had, you know, talked, you know, on, you know, talked through, you know, Twitter pretty frequently, you know, from that point. And, you know, I was, you know, but this was, you know, the first time, you know, that I was going to, you know, meet him in person. And one of, a really good friend of mine had, you know, had kind of, that was worried about, you know, that was local. You know, I had, with somebody that I had been trying to help find a doctor, you know, he had gone kind of, you know, just silent over the weekend. And it was, you know, that, you know, we were there to protect, you know, he said, well, have you heard from, you know, someone said, because he knew I was trying to, you know, it's like, no, you know, no, I was like, I think I'm afraid to, I'm afraid to Google or, you know, just check. I'm like, I'm afraid I'm going to see a obituary. And of course there was, there, you know, when I finally got the, in the right frame of mind to do that, you know, he had passed away.
Wow.
I want to talk a little bit more about your list, because I think it's important to understand just how robust this database is. The first question I have, and I think it's important for everybody listening, why is it so controversial to talk about deaths by suicide among chronic pain patients?
I think some people believe, you know, that this is going to trigger more deaths. You know, it's going to talking about the, you know, about, you know, the whole, you know, it's been disproven, you know, with research, but, you know, people fear that, you know, talking about suicide is going to make more people commit suicide. But, you know, or that these are just patients that, you know, have developed an addiction and they couldn't face up to that addiction. And so they, you know, and they wanted to blame it on the fact that they had chronic pain rather than, you know, they had an addiction, so they committed suicide. And they just couldn't face up to what, you know, but that's so often not the case. If they say they're just depressed, you know, and they, you know, weren't facing up to their, you know, they weren't trying to deal with their depression. But there are a lot of these people where it really was not about, you know, 20 of them, you know, where it was coexisting depression and pain. But there were plenty where it was not even about depression, really. This was about people that were just not willing to live without a decent quality of life.
Yeah. It's tough. As you know, you and I have both spoken to patients who have chosen a certain path, who have struggled to deal with their pain, that are also now continuing to deal with their pain. What really confuses me is that so many patients in a state of chronic pain cannot generate the credibility needed to get the quality of care that they deserve. And I'm not sure if I'm phrasing it the right way, but credibility is always the term that comes to mind. Is that the right word in your opinion? And if it is, like, what can we do to start giving chronic pain patients the care that they need?
I think that's a huge part of it. I mean, you have the way that our society, you know, we're this, you know, capitalist, you know, free market, you know, economy. Everybody, you've got to work hard, you know, be on Social Security. That's not, you know, I mean, that's, you know, as, you know, it's it, people cast suspicion, you know, if somebody, you know, on Social Security, we cast suspicion, you know, that we value people that are tough, you know, people that persist in spite of pain, you know, not people that, you know, take medication. We mistrust, you know, we think, you know, oh, people, they've developed addiction, you know, they're high, they like the way it feels, you know, things like that. And, you know, or what the medication, you know, they're doing this to, you know, all sorts of things cause us to, you know, mistrust. And basically, we've taken all the awful stigmas that we have against people with addiction that are so undeserved and so wrong. And now we've taken those. And I think a lot of this has come from some of the advocacy groups that are trying to help people with addiction. And the help that they're trying to provide to people with addiction, that's needed, but then they're casting all those stigmas that they want to get, that they want to free people with addiction from on patients with chronic pain. And I think that's just, it's
interesting.
You know, there's all this, I'm sorry, I guess I got cut off track, I'm sorry.
No, not at all. The point you're making is that patients with chronic pain have certain unique needs. They need to be seen in a certain light, and lumping patients with substance use dependency with chronic pain patients and assuming the behavioral tendencies of one group versus the other can be conflated leads to undeserved stigma and, in many ways, poor quality of care, as we've seen with many of the patients. And I think that you've phrased that quite eloquently, and I thank you for your honesty, because it's important to have these open conversations, because that's how we start to bring forward the proper narratives. I want to talk now about this list, the database that you've created. A couple of things. One, have you noticed discrepancies in the data you're collecting and data that may have been populated by law enforcement, by public health advocates? Do you see a certain discrepancy in what you're collecting, what you're seeing, and what is publicly reported?
There are deaths that where I know that they've been listed as accidental. Accidental overdose. An accidental death. The manner of death is accidental versus being, homicide or suicide or natural. And there are a lot of those I know are suicides, because I've got suicide notes for those patients. Yet they're listed as accidental by the medical examiners. Acknowledged. I mean, it's like it never happened.
It's tough because the denial just creates this emptiness. And, you've done an amazing job in making sure that their stories are told. What pushback have you encountered, or what sort of negativity have you faced in creating your database from sources that maybe you'd expect to see that kind of blowback from, and from people that you're quite surprised that would look at your efforts in a less than positive light?
Well, to me, it's like why I'm eyeing on it. You see, the CDC, they're like the premier, public health organization. These are the statistical wizards in the country. People that know all, that are like, that have, just all this evident knowledge experience that I don't have a drop of. And they're the ones that are equipped to do this, and they could do so much better job and get this much more comprehensive. They've got access to all the databases where they can get the manner, death certificates. They can be having nationwide surveys. Have you lost a loved one to suicide? With the study, CSI opioid study. They could be doing all of this, but yet they aren't. And then there, it shocks me. And when the CDC announced their intention to, have the meeting in the fall of 2019, to start working on a new guideline, I registered to attend. And, I have always tried to be, never to be, respectful, and just somebody that is not going to hog the microphone, or try to be good participant if I go to any public meeting. And I was so shocked when I was actually boarding Greyhound, because I was going to take Greyhound because I don't have my own transportation, from Birmingham to Atlanta, and I got a call from one of the CDC officials that was in charge of the meeting, basically that, was not going to be able to attend because they had deemed me a security risk. And little me in the wheelchair. If you're secure, and that to me was, to me that just said, gosh, they, unless it's just their algorithms. That shocked. Why would they, if they truly want to make this better, why would they not want the people that are trying to document what's happening, to attend? And then there's some patient advocate. There's a patient advocacy group that's very large and has worked you know, at times it's been aligned, you know, with some of the efforts that Prof had to, you know, develop the CDC guidelines, to begin with. And there were people from that group, you're encouraging people to commit suicide, if you're doing this. And I was just shocked. I mean, some of these patients, when I've gotten stuff, people, they're going to try to do something, stay up all night trying to find a doctor. That's not what you do if you want to encourage somebody to try to keep them alive. We've already lost way too many people. But, I don't know how there could ever be pushback, and then there was Dr. Tess, he probably told you about, he was at this meeting, and he's talking about suicide and this during the question and answer, and physician, she spoke, she's like, well, I've got a question about these deaths, and just basically that we don't need to spend the money studying these deaths. It's how are our lives not worth,
Before we move on, I want to recap a few things you said, because I found that to be very powerful and dare I say a bit hurtful. When you were on your way to attend a CDC meeting, you personally traveled from Birmingham, Alabama to Atlanta, Georgia to attend a CDC meeting.
Well, actually, I was just boarding the bus and I got this phone call. So I was able to get off the bus before the bus left Birmingham. But they said, I said that I was a security risk. And so they said, you can participate in the meeting online. And so I did.
Okay, but not in person.
Right. Because I was a security risk.
Wow. And they also stated that through your advocacy, by stating the lived experiences of those with chronic pain that did not receive the adequate care that they needed and died by suicide or died by other means, that by documenting their life story, you are, in a sense, increasing the risk of suicide or encouraging others to follow that path?
Okay, let me correct on that. That was actually,
yeah.
What I've had is just, there was a patient, a chronic pain, group that is one where they have worked with Prophet Times, on focusing on mindfulness and things like that. Some of their people at one point, fellow patients, you shouldn't be doing this. You're encouraging people to commit suicide with this. This is not, you could be doing so much, you could be doing good here. You could be encouraging them to cope and to do that, and not to be so reliant on medication and,
it's interesting to see the aggressive pushback you're receiving, because in many ways they're telling you how you should advocate for your own condition. Is that a fair characterization?
Right. I mean, that's just something that happened once. I mean, that's really the only,
and
I would say those are the two examples of pushback that I've had.
And I think that's interesting, because what you see now when it comes to opioid settlements, when it comes to characterizing lived experiences, there is a pervasive narrative on how we should advocate. But what you're seeing and what you're suggesting is that instead of identifying ahead of time how to advocate, have the stories of those affected lead your advocacy. Is that a right reading on how you're looking at this?
You're breaking up a little bit. I'm not sure I'm understanding what you were meaning on that.
Yeah, so when you're advocating for patients, do you often find pressure to advocate for a certain way or push a certain type of agenda? Or do you let the stories then determine how you advocate? I'm just trying to piece together all these complex narratives together, because the more you delve into all of this, the more convoluted it seems. And the sense that I'm getting is that many patients in your situation are often told how to advocate as opposed to advocating for what they truly believe in. And I'm just curious to see if that's a fair characterization or if you feel like that's oversimplifying how you really feel.
I don't think I've experienced a lot of that. To me, I think, you know, kind of that little bit of pushback, that, you know, example of where I have gotten that pushback from those patients, you know, that was one thing that happened. But beyond that, to me, I don't think I have experienced anything like that. And as far as like having people telling me what to do, I mean, if it's people that, you know, are experienced, that, you know how to communicate with people and know how to, you know, handle things and understand, you know, how government works and things like that. I mean, to me, please help me. Tell me what I need to do to be more effective. Please help me, you know, teach me. I mean, to me, I think that's,
yeah,
you know, good anybody that can help can help us.
No, I think that's the right mindset. In that vein, can you talk a little bit about your work with Dr. Stephen Cortez and the studies that you guys are focusing on in terms of telling the stories of patients who've lost their lives by suicide and chronicling the lived experiences?
When the cuts really first started, you know, around, you know, when things really started to get bad in 2015, I remember saying to, to a psychologist that I know well, you know, they need to study this, you know, somebody needs to, you know, they need to see what's happening, you know, see what this does to patients, you know, make sure, you know, that if they're causing harm, you know, they need to document that, you know, they need to figure out, you know, and this is somebody that cares and, you know, that's an ally, that, gosh, you know, oh, you know, you're dreaming, you know, that's never going to happen, you know, that's never going to happen. And, you know, people would say, you know, you're just not going to see that. You got to, you know, pull your expectations. So when back in, it was like in, I think probably early, maybe early 2018, late 2017, Dr. Cortez had said, you know, and I haven't seen, you know, the spreadsheet that I've got, you know, I've sent it to him, you know, is it got, you know, updated? Well, it would have been like, 2018, 2019. He said, well, you know, send me that again. He's like, I want to, you know, I'm going to get my fellow, Dr. Allison Barley at the time, this fellow, we're going to look at this. We're going to try to see if we can find a way to create a study to look at these suicides. And you could have just knocked me over with a feather. It was like, oh my God, this is, you know, what hoped and prayed for. And then, yeah. You know, there were 7 grant applications to get this study to the point that it is now. And it's just, to me, it's like, you know, I'm just so happy to see this finally happening, and so grateful to him for being so stubborn. And Dr. Barley, you know, both of them for sticking this out, keeping going, not 1 denial, 2 denials, 3, 4, yeah. 5, yeah, kept going, and, yeah. Making things better, you know, making the protocol better, you know, with input, you know, with each critique. And I truly think that this is going to be able to show, look, there's, you know, it's not just one thing that's happening when all these patients commit suicide. It's, there's different things that had, or at least from what I've seen. But if we can, get this documented and move these from just mere anecdotes that can get, swept under the rug, or they can, where people can say, oh, it's just always just this or just that, or, and then, because this will get the qualitative information, that, hey, this is what's happening. And then from there, to work and get better protocols that can provide protection for patients and help people and help promote quality, help promote quality of life for patients. I think, the prescribing cuts and the prescribing reduction, safe prescribing is a great thing. It's truly safe. But what we're doing right now is not safe. What we're doing now is creating danger. We're putting people at risk.
Ms. Fuqua, one thing I have to say, for all the praise Dr. Cortez and other folks at UAB receive for their persistence in getting this study off the ground, it's a truly a testament for you and just the power in your vision to carry this forward. And I want to make sure for everybody who's listening that so much of this study, which is the first study of its kind to study death by suicide among chronic pain patients, was in large part due to the efforts that you have initiated. So, everybody who's listening to this, please give Ms. Fuqua a round of applause, because your advocacy, those moments when you kept pushing, when nobody else would push, that's what led to this point. And it's just, I'm just amazed to see the courage and resiliency that you've shown. I want to talk a little bit about the clinical study itself in non-technical terms, more for the general audience who may come across the study in the near future. The study is going to focus on lived experiences. It's going to study actual stories of patients. And what's unique about the way the study is formatted is that it's going to use interview style data collection, which is a little bit different than the traditional format by which clinical studies populate data, populate patient information. Why is that important for patients in this situation?
Well, the patients, that are being studied, it's the family members that have to, they're speaking for them. But those are people, the family members and the friends that were there with them through this journey. These people, they saw this, and everything that goes into a life is not something that can come up on a, on a clinically validated, questionnaire. I mean, there's, these different questionnaires that they have, when you do, research, those have a purpose, but, people are so much more complicated than this. And qualitative research like this, where it's interviews and you look at the themes from what, the participants, provide, and, gives, I guess, much, more detail, richer data, things that, if you don't know to ask the question, or you don't know something exists, the survey can't check for it.
Yeah.
And that's how this, you come up with, from the open-ended questions, you get data that you didn't know to ask for.
No, it makes perfect sense. And you, more than anybody else, would know the importance of all this. You know more than anybody else how difficult health policy has been for these patients